pass this down?
You can pass some of these down, too. Okay, Perek Tes Pasuk Beis pretty much encapsulates the biggest problem this book has. Basically, it's something shared by many other prophets. I don't know if any of you had time to look up Chavakuk, the beginning of that Sefer, and see how it's Mamshech Chutzpah, that prophet speaks. Here, basically, the problem is Akol Kasher Akol, Mikra Echad LaTzadik ULaRasha. That good happens to bad people, bad happens to good people, whatever a bad person deserves, a good person gets, what a good person deserves, a bad person gets. However you slice it, this is the biggest problem of a reader of the Bible. God, you make certain promises, you don't come through. This is basically the stuff of wisdom literature, of sapiential literature, as we call it, and how to maintain your own while everything around you seems to be unraveling. We just happened to this morning in one of my Bible classes at YU just to discuss Cain and Hevel, and I posited that it may very well be that Cain's carbon was greater than Hevel's. Now, I know I'm taking a very, very seriously a path leading close to heresy. Why? Because all the commentaries insist that Hevel's sacrifice was better than Cain's, for the simple empirical reason that God favored Hevel. So if God favors Hevel, Hevel must be better.
Could have been a test.
Could have been a test to Cain. But if it is a test, the biblical reader has to say something about the two korbanos. Thanks so much. Has to say something about the two korbanos to prove that Cain's was greater than Hevel's.
Well, first,
Okay, Hevel he become who? But God allows copycats to... Okay, Stanley is saying what Rashi says. Stanley says that by Hevel's korban, it says, Vayoveh mi bechoros tzono umechel behen. Hevel brought from the first of his flocks, and Cain didn't bring meracious prihadama. He just brought mi prihadama of the fruits of the ground. Rashi says, minababiyada, whatever came to him. Can you use some internal evidence from the story that might indicate why Hevel's korban is not as good as Cain's? And then I'm moving into an Ecclesiastes kind of debate over, could it be that God in the story was actually favoring the lesser of the two in order to teach man a valuable lesson, an important lesson, that these things happen, stuff happens, now get on with it, brush yourself off, and the tzaddik falls seven times and gets up. What do you think? What do you have?
Maybe the Rosh Hashanah spoke to Cain, but he never spoke to Hevel.
Okay.
So that
might be...
you'd think that intuitively, God would only speak to...
Cain deserved the respect. He thought of it first. He was maybe bested by his brother, but I want some internal evidence from the story itself that something that's better about Cain's carbon than Hevel's. I guess you didn't really have to look at the text, but it's not going to be a duke in any pasuk.
Can I ask a question that I would ask as a lawyer? What's the virtue in sacrifice? Because I can't answer the question what's better
Absolutely.
Unless I know what the virtue
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. The virtue in sacrifice is that we have to give up something of our own in order to show my appreciation. So I think there you got you. I think you're right on the track. Each one has to give up something of their own. That's what the sacrifice is, right? But what's the difference between the two? Hevel is giving up something he doesn't use.
Meat.
Meat. We're not eating meat now.
Wonderful.
He could have shorn those sheep before he brought them. I don't know.
Wonderful.
It says in the text, what's the thing that the text stresses that he brought? Their fat.
That's brilliant.
Cain gave fruit.
Yeah.
He eats that. Cain gave up made a greater sacrifice than Hevel.
That's irrefutable.
Well, I have the other side where Hevel, by Hevel it says, in Hevel it says, Mechel Mevechoros Tzono. The first of something always tends to be the best. And Cain doesn't bring the first of his fruits. But
who cares?
But that's it doesn't matter. Hevel is not giving up. Is not making a sacrifice.
He's not doing anything.
So, but this fits very well into Koheles. the guy who deserved. Look at this pasuk. Look at Perek Tes Pasuk Beis.
It's still irrefutable.
I take it from you. So, Stanley, what did you ask?
I don't know if this makes a difference, but is the kind of fat they're talking about the kind that now we're allowed to eat, or kind of
I think irrelevant at that time in history. Although I must tell you, Stanley, your point is well taken. I once saw it in, I think, Iturei Torah, that Cain was saying to Hevel, what can you bring, seeing that we're not eating what you're bringing? What good is that? And Hevel said, yeah, well, in the future we're going to bring the chalev on the altar that we don't eat. So that's I have to tell you, is I think is drush. It's good Shalosh Shuvos Torah, but it's I'm not saying it's not a possible exposition, but I think it's beyond what we're doing here. Yes. What is your first name? I'm sorry.
Amy.
Yes.
Speaking as a teacher, sometimes when sometimes you have students who can grasp things at different levels or have more to give in different areas, and sometimes there is a child who can't perform as well, who isn't as advanced as another student, but you give him more encouragement and more, you take what he gives, even if it's a lesser quality.
Be very careful of what that does to others and jealousies in others, but the teacher knows how to balance that.
In order to bump that child.
Be careful where you're going with this. Is God not a good teacher?
I'm not.
Mixed results.
I'm not saying that, but maybe sometimes you take you have to be careful with the way you do that.
So
sometimes the other child.
This is that. I love where you're going with this.
Doesn't necessarily recognize.
This is. Look, these discussions. Chazal said, "Don't be careful learning this book. It may drive you to heresy." But I don't believe we're being heretical here. I think that Koheles wants to take us to a responsible place of all of the bad things that can happen to us, and not to drop living in the yoke of the burden of humanity because we see inconsistencies in our lives or in other lives. The man writing this has all the pleasures of the world.
But God can't be a perfect teacher, otherwise there would be nothing left for man to do.
I think God is doing something here, if we're according to the way we're reading it, that any third grader would say, but that's not fair. Our kids have a very good sense of what's fair, but God is trying to tell Cain, if you learn this lesson properly and brush yourself off and go about the next one with good intentions, I will appreciate that one. I will respect that one, and you will learn a valuable lesson. Life isn't always fair. Get on with it.
That's not the point. Fair. It's a father teach his children depending on, and God is
100%.
Our father.
How does a father teach a child to walk? By putting out his hands, and just as the child is ready to reach out, he pulls his hands away. That kid might fall and get a scrape, but that's how you're going to learn to walk.
I mean, there's also the idea that the whole conversation that God has with Cain afterwards is basically saying, "I didn't accept your problem because I know you could do better." Like, how about this was all he could do?
You're the firstborn. You have the potential. I'm talking to you, right? Who said before? Who's that? That was you, Johnny? I'm talking to you, Cain. Right? I mean, what's better than that?
Right.
On the other hand, there's very little to compare to in terms of human behavior. Not too many humans around.
Okay, but this is the story is being learned by people for the first time who have lots of humans around. But I'll tell you this. Can we, around this table, remember we talked about the ontological proof of the existence of God, of something that's in the imagination. Can we, around this table, I imagine every single person can, imagine, whether you do so as a teacher, a friend, a parent, or whatever it is, can you imagine something that you could have said to Cain that day, given the state you have as God, in Cain's eyes, can you imagine saying something to Cain that day to have put off this fratricide?
This is
going to
be written in a book that's
going to
be read by a lot of
you. Sometimes the reaction of
the person. I mean, after all, God knows everything. Hi, Alan. It's good to see Alan. How's Ripka Bas Miral?
That's right, I know.
You know, we can do that right at the end of class. You can say Tehillim and make a Mishabarach for both Alan's parents because he's 7 minutes up.
Alan's parents.
So, Kathy, can you think of what Hashem could have told Cain that day? Vayomer Hashem al Cain. Go ahead.
You did a great job. Just need a little more approval.
Yeah, why couldn't God give him that approval? You know what the Gemara calls that approval? The bread of shame. Have you ever heard of that terminology in Aramaic? Lechem kisufa. I think there's Yiddish terminology for it too. It's a shanda for Hashem to give a free ride.
Well, but look back.
You want a free ride?
But just look back a little more. And God is posing questions to Adam and Chava. You know, like where is
looking for your tshuva? Yeah.
In other words,
God works with us like a person.
So God is being didactic, you know, a little bit earlier, and then all of a sudden here somebody gets whacked, and there's no standards to go by. So what's there?
There's a lot of dynamics between Cain and Hevel. There's a lot of the sibling stuff. There's wow, organic figs.
Wow.
Okay. Let's make it. I think it deserves the issue. Shefi Yonim. Yeah, but it's organic figs. I don't think I've ever had organic.
Shefi Yonim for you? Organic.
What is the word by getting?
Yeah, why do they have to learn while it's going on? Why can't there be like little saying, "Oh, this is how I like."
I will definitely have one of these.
Okay. And things are very open at this time.
I know, but why does it seem to be like that?
What?
Is Cain punished? Cain just something happened that made Cain and Hevel. Right, Cain saw something and Hevel saw something. Or Hevel saw something and Cain didn't see something. Rashi just says that the cloud came down onto Hevel, but nothing happened to Cain. Oh my gosh. Wow.
Well, you know,
it happens.
Today's
your first day here, and we heard you were coming.
But if God gives by questioning a chance for Adam to, you know, giving a chance for a person to recognize circumstances, then it doesn't seem so this time around, except after the deed is done.
The question here isn't so much what was done, but how you react to the way that God approaches the
maybe.
It's almost as if though. What hurts Cain more is the cover up, right? Rashi writes that God was looking for Hevel to say, "I don't know what I did. I was upset. I was angry. I grabbed him. I choked him. I don't know what that is." I mean, we haven't had that experience before of what you do to a person when you're angry with them and then they stop moving and they're in little pieces all over the floor. I don't know what that. Instead, he says, "Hashem Rokhi Anochi." And the Medrash, by the way, the words "Hashem Rokhi Anochi" is the end of a week-long conversation between God and Cain. And you see, you know where the Medrash is coming from, because the answer I would have given if I was confronted by God, after all, I just thought a few days ago that he deserves my sacrifice. The answer to the question, where is Hevel, your brother? I would say, I don't know. What's Hashem Rokhi Anochi? So the Medrash, this is what Medrash is made for. Builds a whole conversation between God and Cain with a lot of these inyanim, and the last word of the conversation is, you know, God, I'm not his keeper, I'm not his guardian, leave me alone. So this is all building up to what I want to do with you with this sheet. Does everybody have one? I passed it around last week and I had a few extras today. This is kimat also an exercise in midrashic. Kathy, you have one there? An exercise in midrashic methodology. I would like to read it from Vayikra Rabba rather than from Kohelet Rabba. The reason for that is because Vayikra Rabba is a primary source of Midrashim. Kohelet Rabba is taken many, many years later than that. So the original Midrash comes from Vayikra Rabba. Okay?
Who wrote the Midrash?
We don't really know. Medrash Rabba, so to say, is not certainly all written at one time. Okay. Vayikra Rabba and Bereishis Rabba are written first, hundreds of years before the other three to the Torah, and the five Megillos were put together many years later.
The Megillos are the Medrash on the Megillos.
These are the Midrashim on the Megillos. Okay, does everybody have one? Should I make more copies? I have another one here if anyone needs.
Oh, sorry.
Everyone have one? You have one right there?
No.
Okay. The text says that it's sorry to see that the tzaddik and the rasha share the same fate. The Tov, the Tahar, and the Tameh share the same fate. Now here he has two good ones and one bad one, right? La Zoveach, La Sher'enenu Zoveach. Apparently the sacrificer, the Zoveach is the good one. The one who refuses to sacrifice is the bad one. Katov, Kachote, the good, the sinner. It's the second time he has the word good. Right? Hanishpa, Kasher Shvua Yarei. Apparently the good one is the one that refuses to make the oath. The Shvua Yarei is the good guy, right? The Nishpa is the bad guy. Right?
I'm sorry, where are you reading
from? Test Pasuk Beis. All in one Pasuk. Right? Right, I have five pairs of people. One is tzaddik and rasha. Okay, that's in your deeds. Your deeds determine whether you're a tzaddik or a rasha. Tzaddik Hashem b'chol derechav v'chassid b'chol ma'asav. Tameh and tohar is in your body. Zoveach is what you sacrifice in terms of your assets, your money. Tov and chotei is in terms of what's in your heart. Nishba is in terms of what's in your mouth. It touches upon all different types of human activity and what may be considered good and bad behavior. And let's take a look at what the Medrash does. Want to start with me? And by the way, this is the beauty of this Medrash. You see how it starts with Shimon Pasach. Whenever you see a Medrash of someone Pasach, he opens up the discussion with such a Medrash. Remember I told you last week how that works? You're in Vayikra, the Parshas of Shavua Zacharei Mos, and you open up with a pasuk way out in left field. This is the midrashic way of studying that day, as opposed to today, where we start off with the familiar. The opening line tends to be in this week's Parsha, which is familiar to the people who are in Shul, right? And then you don't know where the rabbi's going. What's he going with this? At that time, what they did was they went from the unfamiliar. The rabbi in Parshas Achremos would start with a pasuk in Chavakuk and Eov in Kohelet, someplace way out in Ksuvim, in a place where there's no Haftorah, after the word Pasach, and then he would weave the story back into Achremos. Okay, something about Shnei Bnei Aharon. Now, while we're doing that, try to figure out what it is. Okay, so Rabbi Shimon Pasach, Hakol Kasher Lakol, Mikra Echod Atzadik Olerasha. Who's the tzaddik? I think we started with this last week, right? Zeh Noach. Shnemar bo ish tzaddik. So why are we so quick to call Noach the tzaddik and not Moshe or someone else? Because remember,
Yosef
is known in Chazal as Yosef HaTzaddik, but not yet at this time.
Oh.
Yosef is never the only person in the whole Tanakh called tzaddik directly.
Noach.
Is Noach. Open up a concordance and see. Right?
Yosef HaTzaddik.
Yosef HaTzaddik, but that's because there's a pasuk in Amos which Chazal associate with Yosef in the drash, and the pasuk talks about a tzaddik sold for a pair of shoes. That's the Torah by Yeshev. But in Pshat, that's not talking about Yosef. It's talking about a contemporary of Amos, a poor person who's sold into slavery because he can't afford to pay back a debt on a pair of shoes. Okay, now, so that's the tzaddik. Alright, that's just a tradition from Bereshis Rabba that says that Noach was made into a trefa when he left the Teva in order to explain why every other person, it says of them, Bayoled Bonim Uvanot. Noach had the fewest children in all of Parshas Bereshis and Noach. Everyone else has sons and daughters. Noach doesn't. Why? Because he was broken by this. There's another opinion that Chum castrated him. Okay. Ula Rasha. So the Medrash wants to do the following. Who is opposite Noach who had a similar fate of being crippled? This is a no-brainer because his name sounds like Noach. Ula Rasha. Ze Paro Necho. Kibun shebikesh leishev al kisei shoshlamo lo yoyedei minagov v'kisho ari ushvaro zemes tzoleya v'zemes tzoleya hainu dechsiv mikra echod latzadik ula rasha. This one died crippled, that one died crippled. Both crippled by a lion. Noach for not feeding him quickly enough after the flood, and Paranecho for daring to sit on Shlomo's throne without realizing that the lions on the side would... Now, wow, that is... I don't know how this Medrash cares for me to believe this. But that's not the important point. The important point is that the only person called a tzaddik, shares the same fate as a person who is eminently wicked. Continue. Lato v'latahor v'latomei. Now I have two good ones and one bad one. What's a good two tag team in the Tanakh? Moshe and Aaron. Take a look. Batov ze Moshe, shnemar batera uso kitovhu. Rav Meir Moshe nolad mahul. Alright, what is Batov? He was born not requiring a bris. Batahor ze Aharon, shehaya osek batara, son shal Yisrael, shnemar v'shalom v'mishor halach, iti v'rabim heshiv ma'on. That's alright, I don't need to put a proof text in Malachi, but it says, we know that Aharon's business was to make people to be pure. V'latamei, elam araglim. Now, can you see how did they share the same fate?
They both
didn't get in to get into Israel. Good. You see where this message is going. Elu amru shivcho shal Eretz Yisrael, ve'elu amru gnai. Elu lo nechnesu, ve'elu lo nechnesu. Hayinu dechsiv, latov, latahor, v'latamei. The tov and the tahor didn't get into Israel, and the tamei didn't get into Israel. What good is there to be a tov and tahor? Right? Lazoveach. Ze Yoshiyahu, Shnemar v'yorem Yoshiyahu livnei ha'am, tzon kvasim uvnei izim. Who was a man who sacrifices? That would be Yoshiyahu. It says of him that he did so. V'lasher einenu zoveach? Alright, this you have to know your Tanakh. Achav and Yoshiyahu died exactly the same death. The same death described mamish. Both in battle, both wearing armor, where an archer found an arrow that went pierced the armor. And they both said, take me out of here, ki hochleisi ma'od. I'm dire sickness, I'm about to die. They both died of the same thing. So you see, here Ahav is the worst king of Israel. Ein lo chelek b'olam haba. He's the einenu zoveach, because why? Shebitel karbanos. In his day, his wife did it, but in his day, remember his wife Jezebel, they made it so that no one should bring karbanos. Right? So this one was the zoveach. That's Yoshiyahu. This is the Eino Zoveach. They both died the same way in battle.
Why not King Menashe?
Why isn't... Yoshiahu.
Why can Asha Rasha not mention?
Menashe. That's one point. Menashe doesn't fit opposite someone else. This Medrash has to get five pairs of righteous, in some cases two of them, righteous and wicked, where they have the same fate. Menashe's fate doesn't match a righteous man, at least at this point. Okay? Alright. What's next? Katov kachote. Katov de David shnemar v'shlach v'yaveo v'hu tov ro'i. Okay. Kachote de Nebuchadnezzar shnemar v'chatecha k'tzdaka prok. That's supposed to get the Neil. Zebona beis hamikdash u'malach mem shana. V'zehi chriv beis hamikdash u'malach mem shana. That's a little off, my friends, because Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 45 years, and I'm sure this Medrash knows it. When it says 40, it's rounding it off. Okay, I don't know what to tell you. It should have said about 40 years. The Medrash knows it. I can't believe the Medrash is going to be just so flagrantly contradict what is so clear in Gemara's and in Tanakh. Nebuchadnezzar ruled 45 years. Anyway, David and Nebuchadnezzar are this one, but also David didn't build the Beis Hamikdash. Shlomo did. So why is David the one that's opposite? Because there's no pasuk in Tanakh they call Shlomo Tov. It has to fit the pasuk after all. So why is David called the builder of the Beis Hamikdash? Because David set up the building of the Beis Hamikdash. He arranged, purchased the land. He arranged all the building in Divrei Yamim. Good. And all the designs and the architect with Shmuel. Correct. Yes.
A little strange how this Medrash is trying to sort of really fit square pegs around holes. I mean, why doesn't it just say, look, you know what? I mean, we're sure that there are circumstances where this occurs, but what, I mean...
It's just a very creative Medrash that's giving a chart of five on this side, five on this side. To show real life cases, even in biblical times, where it's just not fair. How does Yoshiahu and Ahav share the same fate?
Right.
How does this work with the Torah that makes certain guarantees? I mean, come on, what's going on here? Life is a series of ups and downs, and you have to be prepared to deal with the downs.
Didn't the prophet plead with Yoshiahu, tell him not to?
Yes, that's...
he had his chance.
That was the Gemara. We just did that Gemara in Masechet Tainis, yeah. In Daf Yomi.
He had a chance
to. He didn't listen to Yirmiyahu, to let the Egyptians up the northern border.
Yeah,
he's also
in the
Tisha B'Av. Yeah, Tisha B'Av. Yes. Yeah,
the two pairs of fives reminds me of the Lukas.
Mm-hmm.
There's some effort by the writer of the Midrash to de-stress something.
Not familiar with it, because there's no indication that one side of the Lukas should be better than the other.
Why five?
The question about the Luchos is a good question. Why is it divided five and five when there's so many more words on the first five than on the second five? But okay, so here's a tough one. Kanishba, who's the one who swears freely? Zetzit Kiyahu. Shnamar v'gam b'melech Nebuchadnezzar marad kasher shvu yarei ze shimshon shnamar v'yemer lahem shimshon yishavu li pentiv kun v'zem zemez b'nikoranai v'zei enetzit keo iver. It's not quite clear in this medrash why Shimshon is the good guy and Tzidkiyahu is the bad guy. And even then, the fact that they make Tzidkiyahu the bad guy is dependent on a medrash elsewhere that the medrash here elaborates on afterwards. But one thing is clear, Tzidkiyahu and Shimshon both were blinded by the enemy. Right? Now, how creative is this Medrash? Could we think of other pairs in the Tanakh that share similar fates? It's, we get the point. How does this fit into Acharei Mos? You can look inside. There's a group of people in the Torah that want to bring a korban because they feel you shouldn't limit this kehuna work to just Aaron and his sons. Aaron's two sons do bring a korban and suffer for it, right? Chazal generally do not look askance at Aaron's sons. They say they died a righteous death, they got too close to God, they were too enthusiastic, right? There's another group of people in the Torah who just with great chutzpah stand up to Moshe and say, you Kohanim are taking too much upon yourself. We want to also bring incense. We want to also sacrifice. Moshe basically sets them up. Moshe knows what's going to happen if they do it, and he lets them do it. Because there's a lot at stake with Korach's revolt. Right, I think you got it all. So that's what the Medrash does. It says, see, Korach did this, Nadab and Abihu did a similar thing, and see, they shared the same fate. So the Gemara says, for instance, Chayi Mezoni Ubani Tolui B'mazel gives three pairs of rabbis, one who dies at 40, one who dies at 95, one whose all his children went off the derech and worshipped the Avodah Zarah and became Roman citizens, and the other one had a great nachas and all his sons became rabbanim, and one who was phenomenally wealthy and one had to scrape together for two coins in his pocket at the same time. So the Gemara says, is there any explanation why this one had this and that one had that? So you know, this one's mazel was a little different. Now you can argue and say, oh, no, everyone reaps what they sow and everyone makes their own bed, and that's a mistake. There's something fundamentally wrong, because that's what Eov's friends do in the book. If your sons died, it must be that they're sinners. I told you on many occasions that, you know, Eov's friends want so much to defend God that their defense of God, according to God himself, in the end of the book, becomes somewhat heretical.
Yeah.
You defend God to such an extent that God goes to his friends and says, you will die if Eov doesn't pray for you, because you did not speak as well of me as Eov did. Mm-hmm. And of course, I always ask the same question, God, did you just read this book? Eov's friends were the firmest you can come up with, you can imagine. Eov is the one who indeed did seem to spew some degree of heresy.
But then that makes being from into an instrumental...
Yeah, you're just serving yourself. You're taking the easy way out. Corellus doesn't want to take the easy way out. And neither should you when it causes so much pain to a suffering man.
If being good means you'll be wealthy and happy and all of that, then it's not being good.
Correct. You mean, Eov asked his friends, you mean when I had all the pleasures of life, that was your proof that I was a righteous man? That's crazy.
The proof of goodness is in the face of adversity.
There you go. That's what this book is about. The proof of, as I said on Shabbos, the proof of a successful marriage is how they deal with difficulties and arguments, not how they deal when everything's going well. And also, that Eov's friends make the mistake of just determining whatever the person does based on what happens to him in the world. Your children must have sinned if this is what happened to them.
It's also magical thinking which denies human freedom.
But it takes such a simplistic way out. This is the way some people try to explain the Holocaust. This is the way some people try to explain such an easy way out. And Eov says, you know, I can deal with all this suffering. Suffering, I'm okay with all this. I accepted the bad. I accept the bad. What's the one thing Eov says in his book that makes this suffering interminable, unacceptable, impossible, that my friends, the people I was closest with, say I deserve it? You hear that again? That my friends say I deserve it. That they are looking at me as someone who is not the person they thought they knew because of this suffering. That I can't take. I can take all of the losses. I can take the grief, the incredible grief of not having those close to me to share these feelings. And the one that you might think should be closest to him, Mrs. Eov, is no consolation for him. And she has a small share in this. I mean, shouldn't Eov's grief also be Mrs. Eov's grief? She just has two lines in the story.
Doesn't she die?
No, no, she's there till the end. But she only has two lines in the story.
At the end, doesn't he marry? He has two wives and he has twice as many kids or something. No?
I don't think wives are mentioned at the end. Children are mentioned at the end, but I don't think wives are. I could be wrong, but it might be a medrash that you're saying. It's not in the text, but it might be a medrash. But Eov.
Here's the question. Did the friends blame Eov?
He blamed his
the question.
They blamed the question. They blame him. They
the
say,
situation.
This is
how come that happened to you?
The three words encapsulate Ha'enosh Me'eloah Yitzdok. Shall man be more righteous than God? Right? You want to be more righteous than God? Then keep talking. But we don't think so. And with all that frumkeit, God still tells them, you did not speak well of me the way Eov did, because it does not speak well of God to place all the blame of man's suffering on his own sins. You don't know what the big picture is. The big picture is lasting 1,000 years. The importance the Medrash keeps telling us is that, you know, what's happening now could be a consequence of what someone did 100 years ago. And what's more important than that is to understand that the next thing we do may bear consequence 100 years from now.
Somebody could die a miserable death, and 20 years later, it results in something great.
I have no doubt that if Socrates chose to just abandon his teaching, we wouldn't know of him today. I shouldn't say I have no doubt. I'm not so arrogant, but it's very, very likely that so many of these kind of things where, you know, such a beautiful life has to come to an end, but a lot of good came out of that particular thing. You think you're squelching his philosophy, but by doing that, you assured that 2,500 years from now, elementary courses in every college is going to study this man and what you're killing him to keep people from learning what you're killing him for.
But how do you separate that from the martyr ideology of Islam or Christianity? Judaism, Islam and Christianity have the martyr ideology. Judaism does not.
Judaism does too. It says, you know, you should rather die than violate certain precepts.
Right? We don't worship.
Certainly don't worship it, but if someone gives me a gun and says, kill him or I'll kill you, I say, you kill me. I
don't know. Well, crusades and Jews willingly.
That's a matter of great discussion. Right? 100%.
The closest we have to a martyr story is Masada.
And it's very possible that they did wrong.
Shimshon.
The whole communities in the Middle Ages that Johnny's referring to, that the Balei HaTosfos had to contend with. I mean, there's Chaim Soloveitchik wrote an article on this some time ago. You read this, that he says that the reason why Tosfos had to speak well of such behaviors because everyone was doing it. Everyone was really, the Rambam spoke against it. The Rambam says, you shouldn't be martyring for that. But if you forgive me this.
We don't have a martyrology.
There's no question that we, b'chartim b'chayim, and it says b'chay b'hem, and the Torah wants us to live through all this, and there's no question that
there's no virtue of being a martyr in and of itself.
No, but we have the three cardinal sins.
I wouldn't call that suicide, but you have to give yourself over to be killed. What you should do is take the gun and then shoot the guy who's forcing you. They're going to say, okay, I'll kill him, and then you don't kill him. Kill the guy.
Right, I mean, what are you supposed to do if they say, do X or else,
What are the three cardinal sins?
Adultery, idolatry, and murdering someone else. Okay, so.
Back to the Medrash Kohelet. Why doesn't it ever take up the story of where, I forgot who it was, but when they were marching the Aron back from Shiloh?
Uzzah,
yeah. Why don't they never sort of deal with that? Or I haven't seen the sort of.
I actually talked about Uzzah today, and if I don't mind, are you in town this Shabbos?
What's that?
Are you in town this Shabbos?
Yeah.
I'm talking about Uzzah in my drasha this Shabbos.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes, I'm talking because it's my it has to do with the parsha where the Torah says, "Don't come even close to the mountain. If you come, you're going to be, they'll kill you for it." What's that about? What is it that God can't say, all right, I'll give you a mulligan, just don't touch it next time? I mean, the guy meant well, for goodness sake. So we're going to look at that a little bit. Okay. All right, look, how depressing is all this? Who knows? You know, we're trying hard, but God just said, you know what? Listen, guys, every ship comes in. Just stay with the program. Keep your chin up for the new day is going to come tomorrow. Just try to face it with excitement. There are people out there who support you, and there's just some people can just take so much petch and just say, God, I had it already.
Yeah, but the proof of human freedom is adversity.
And then I have the freedom to look at it and say I'm going to still brush myself off and
it means overcoming your natural inclinations to give up.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm sorry.
Was it Viktor Frankl?
Yeah,
Master of
Communion. Oh yeah, sure. It's famous.
Choose somebody else sometimes.
Yeah.
Choose somebody else.
Okay. All right. So let's get back into Kohelet, if I may. Ze ra pasuk gimel. Tera peret gimel. Okay. And Ibn Ezra writes on this pasuk. Does anybody else even have the full text, the full Mikros Gedolos? I'm just going to read the Ibn Ezra in this passage. He says, "Zera b'chol asher nasot tachas haShemesh, ki mikra echod lakol." This is the worst thing that happens under the sun, where the similar things happen to different people who deserve the opposite. And I'm reading Ibn Ezra. "Ein b'chol mash naset tachas haShemesh, davar yoser koshem mizeh." Alkein molei lev bnei adam ra beholei los bilavavam b'chayehem ba'odam b'chayim. Because of these things that we see in the world, people's hearts get filled with, I mean, how could you not get this way? How could you not feel this way? Well, let me tell you, the bread of shame is where everyone's born with $5,000 in one pocket. Okay? And every time they do a mitzvah, another $100 bill comes into the pocket. Every time you do an Avera, a $100 bill is taken out of that pocket.
Mm-hmm. That okay. Is the bread of shame.
Pavlov. What are we, mice? Right? Like
Pavlov.
Okay. So, I mean, there you have it.
Mm-hmm.
And for some very good people, the reward for doing something good is the good. It's just the mm-hmm. good that you spread.
Yeah. Or the
and good. One thing that very much pains Kohelis is where the person that does that good is forgotten and doesn't get the right respect for it or whatnot. That's a big thing earlier in the book. Right?
But you don't need that in order to do good.
The person himself doesn't need it. The person on the outside wants to see it, maybe. Yeah.
The only thing that I find during, I guess, this discussion is that, I mean, we all agree that, you know, you should do good for many reasons. You know, maybe be, you know, altruistic. It could be ulterior motives at work as well. But I feel like, to a certain extent, a lot of, in other words, as we know, I mean, you have the most egregious cases, which is the Holocaust, which, you know, people did good things and, you know, no one's around to record it, no one's around to even benefit from those ultimate good things. And then you have, you know, just on the day-to-day level where, you know, some people just get it, you know, and it just, you know, and some people just don't, you know, no matter what happens, you know, just, you know, like Uzzah, you know, for me is like the quintessential, I guess, Kain. That's why sort of your discussion of Kain just now sort of prompted me to think, oh, that's Uzzah, because in other words, Kain tried. I mean, maybe he didn't, you know, try wholeheartedly, but, you know, you got to give the guy a break. You know, he was the first one to sort of come up with, hey, you know, let me try it. And that's why I think Uzzah is
right in there. Uzzah is the Torah of the Nadav and Avihu, which is the focus of this Medrash.
Right.
This Medrash is just introductory material. It's just Tzedel Aderech. It's a Nash to get on to how does Nadav and Avihu, such two Tzadikei Olam, share the same fate as Adas Korach. All these other things, that's why it's in Achremos Rabbah, in Vayikra Rabbah. So, that's the Torah of Uzzah. And I'm tempted to talk a little about it, but then we still come on Shabbos?
Yeah.
What is the story?
Uzzah was accompanying... The Aron, was the Holy Ark was taken by the Philistines, in the book of Samuel. and it stayed in someone's house for 20 years on its way back to its final place. And finally, David said, now that I conquered Jerusalem, I'd like to take it to Jerusalem. And the man, Avinadav, got the kavod of walking along with it, with his two sons. One was named Achio, and one was named Uzzah. In the Bible, it says that they didn't carry it on the staves with Levium, like the way they did in the desert. They carried it on the back of a wagon of cows, which is ironically the same way the Philistines sent it back to us after it was causing all the havoc there, right? So, the ark started to slip.
When Uzzah saved it.
And Uzzah spontaneously, I mean, there's a big difference between the Nadav and Avihu story and the Uzzah story. With Nadav and Avihu, there is a moral question that comes up, or let's say even a halacha question, but there's time to ask. What should we do? Should we use the fire from there? Should we use the fire from here? Can we come in drunk? Do we have to come in like this? Can we do this? Can we do this? Whatever the thing they did wrong, they certainly had time to ask a shaila of what was right. And they certainly had to whom to turn to ask that question, right? But in the case of Uzzah, there was no time. By the time he asked the question, the aura might be on the floor, which I don't want to see either. But you know, the same goes for the kind of questions we have. We have moral questions. You find a wallet, you find something on the floor, you run into a moral issue. You have time to call up a question and ask advice, a friend or a clergyman or something. Other questions, you know, you see a kid walking into the street, and you see a truck that looks like he's going too fast, not going to stop in time, and you're 15 feet away, and you want to know, am I supposed to put myself into a doubtful, a possible situation of pikuach nefesh in order to save someone who is surely, it seems to be, in the pikuach nefesh? By the time you get an answer to that question, it's never possibly too late. So Uzzah is put into that situation, all right? And you know, God seems to be eminently unfair. David stops the proceedings because he sends the Aaron back. He doesn't even want to continue. Right. So that's why David felt it was his fault.
What happens to Uzzah?
Now it was his fault. Yeah. Hero, that's my reward for protecting the Aaron for 20 years. Is that my son gets killed in returning it?
But how did he die?
He died some kind of euphoric death. Apparently, it just says he. I don't know, he just killed him. Allah Shal means for the mistake.
What was the mistake?
So that's the mistake. It's impossible to fathom. So let me tell you three interpretations. I'll tell you what, I'll tell you, but you no one's going to even have an inkling where I'm going with it. All right? Because why am I doing this in Parshas Yisro?
Well,
okay, should I just tell you... The Yerushalmi, Maseches Sota, says that Uzzah was behaving. Uzzah was behaving very insolently in front of the Aron. He actually, I can only tell you what's written there. You'll excuse me, but it's extremely revealing that the Yerushalmi should say this. It just shows that the Yerushalmi is totally, totally gives up trying to deal with what he did wrong. What did he do? He relieved himself right on the Aron.
Oh, come on.
What? To me, that's such a gnai. It's such a maligning of a man who... Why do you do this to him? I know why they do it. Because they want to be like Eov's friends.
They want to be what?
Like Eov's friends. Right. If Uzzah died, he did something terrible.
Wait,
now, hold it. If Uzzah did something terrible in the biblical text, I'm willing to read it. Let's find it.
But don't make it
okay.
up.
Okay, but don't, that's totally made up. It's fabricated. It's nothing like that is written. So now I go to Rashi. Rashi says what Uzzah did wrong was that he should have realized, I can read it right out of Rashi, that the Aron, which carried the Kohanim across the Yarden in Sefer Yehoshua,
could take care of itself.
The Aron was not going to fall. Now, let me tell you three things I have wrong with this. One, isn't it possible that Uzzah didn't know this?
Sure.
This medrash? Two, isn't it possible that Uzzah was aware of this medrash, but Paskin like the Radak, who says that it's not the Pshat of the Pasuk? in Yehoshua. Three, isn't it possible that Uzzah was aware of this medrash, agreed with it, but didn't quite think of it that second as the Aron was dropping, and he had to act an impulse to push it back up, and then in 2 seconds he could have said, "Oh, I forgot, silly me! I wasn't studying in fourth grade when the Rebbe went over that topic of the Aron crossing the Yarden."
But what's wrong with being gracious and helpful, even if someone can take care of themselves?
He was acting on impulse, for goodness sakes.
No, but if
how does Rashi?
I can put my own coat on. If somebody helps me put my coat on, that doesn't mean they're hurting me.
So yeah, well, what breach of cover to the Aron is there by spontaneously pushing
it? It's a sign of respect.
Now you forgive me. Now I have a third interpretation, which is mine.
Which is?
Mine.
You have to write it up.
I would write this into an article because it is so absurd and so off the wall. But I do have a biblical context to it. Ready? I've asked many a shir, many a crowd, many a group to try to tell me what happened that day. Just paraphrase in English. And I don't think you'll get it. Go ahead, Stanley, you tell us. What happened? I'll start you. Uzzah and Achio are on either side of the Aron, and Abinadab is leading it back to Yerushalayim. What happened?
Did they say the oxen stumbled?
Okay, go ahead. Say something.
And then Uzzah reached forward to do something, but then...
I've only ever heard people say it that way. But that's not the way it's written in the Bible.
Which part in Shmuel?
No, you're saying it perfectly right. Shmuel Beis. The oxen stumbled. They started to fall. It started to tumble. As it fell down. And it pushed up. But that's not the way it's written, neither in Shmuel nor in Divrei Yamim. This is how it's written. Hold on to your seats. It says in Shmuel and in Divrei Yamim, Uzzah put forth his hand to push up the Aron because it started to stumble. It started to slip.
Not the oxen.
That's the same thing. Have you ever heard of a disorder called Munchausen's disorder?
Mm-hmm.
We discussed that once?
Yeah, I don't remember.
You know what it is?
Yes. You create a problem, then you're the hero.
Correct. It's most often a disease that is found in the medical field, mostly with nurses, sometimes very tragically with parents, where a nurse will put in the wrong medication in an IV, wait for the person to go into some kind of shock, preferably with the family around,
and save it.
And when the family's, "What's happening to him? We don't know what's happening," and the nurse just walks in, just nervous, just innocently, and looks at, "That's the wrong medication!" And she takes it off quickly, and they went, "How did you know that? You saved his life!" And they're forever indebted to her. Then only when it starts to happen 7, 8, 10, 12 times with the same nurse do they own up to it and find out that this person killed 15 people. You've read stories about this. Over 20 years they see that this person, they saved 40, right? This person is the top person in the hospital. Every hospital wants this nurse because she's saving so many people. But they don't realize that she's... It's a terrible disorder where you want to be the hero waiting for something bad to happen. Now, there's nothing wrong with being prepared. Right? You can be prepared. You're walking near the Sefer Torah. You're prepared in case it falls. I'm always, when I walk down after Shema Yisrael on Shabbos morning, I'm always put down the sitter so I can be ready to grab a guy if Chas V'Shalom Trump stumbles on the steps. But that would be a far cry from tripping him so he could fall and then grabbing him, and the Shul says, "Wow, the Shul saved him." So they, did you see that? How is he ready to save him? Just like, wow, he saved all of us from fasting 40 days from a drop Sefer Torah. I mean, come on. That's called Munchausen's disorder. And if the Tanakh purposely says, Uzzah pushed forth his hand to grab the Aron because it was slipping.
Maybe he made it slip.
Maybe not.
Totally maybe not. Who am I to impute such behavior? But what I'm trying to do is to explain how God could take such an innocent man for doing something so natural. I'm bothered by Uzzah much more than Cain. And by anyone else, for that matter, Uzzah is the most difficult story in the Bible.
Yeah, easily.
How do you kill him for this? My grandfather told me the most difficult story for him in the Bible is where David gives over those descendants of Shaul to the Givonim at the end of Shmuel Beis. What did they do wrong? The difficult parts of the Bible is where things happen to people where they don't deserve it, for goodness sakes. Right? So it's based on the Medrash that these seven killed Givonim. But then again, that's doing what the Rishalmi did with Uzzah. So what does Munchausen's disorder have to do with Parshas Yisro? That you're going to have to wait for Shabbos for.
Also, it seems a lot of people give the Torah not for a month on the book, but they talk about not of them being the things that's not they're just mentioned in passing there. They should really talk about them Parshas Shemini or something. What happened? But it's something people talk about because it's mentioned incidentally.
Did you attend the shiur I once gave on this topic?
What?
I once gave a shiur, and the crux of the shiur, I'm going to watch it, what's happening? It's crazy. Somebody turn around, it's after 9 o'clock. We started it late, yeah. Acharei Mos is read on Yom Kippur in Eretz Yisrael. Every year. Right? In Eretz Yisrael, Acharei Mos is read on Parshas Acharei Mos once in 3 years. Vayikra Rabbah is an Eretz Yisrael Medrash. Only Vayikra Rabbah and Bereishis Rabbah. All the other Medrashim are written in Bavel. Because these are so early. The fact that Vayikra Rabbah is written for an Israeli audience, where the Torah is read only every 3 years, until the time of the Rambam, means that if you want to say something meaningful about Nadav and Avihu, put it in Acharei Mos. People will read it more often. Vayikra Rabbah were the midrashim that people read, you know, for Parshat Shavua, whatever. That's all they had, right? So that's why this midrash is in Acharei Mos, the Chora. I'm sorry that I had big plans to finish Perek Tes today, for goodness sakes. We finished Pasuk Beis and half of Pasuk Gimel. Alright, but anyway, this is what Ibn Ezra says is the most difficult thing in life.
Should we say the Tehillim?
Yes. Can we say Tehillim for with a Mishabera for Alan's parents? Does everybody know Perakuf Chafala? It's enough.